Support for Connecticut East this week comes from Arisu Anime, New England's premier anime superstore, located in Mystic, Connecticut, with a second location opening May 17th in Fairfield, Connecticut. Visit us at arisuanime, arisuanime.com. Newport Mansions, preserving and presenting 11 historic properties and landscapes, exemplifying three centuries of achievements in American architecture, decorative arts, and landscape design spanning the colonial era to the Gilded Age. Tickets and information at newportmansions.org. And SCAD, the Southeastern Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, is offering a $3,500 sign-on bonus for licensed clinicians. Go to licensedclinicians.org to learn more. That's licensedclinicians.org. They number in the thousands. We're talking about people who are homeless. And since 2021, the number of homeless people in the state has risen 14%, and it's affecting people of all age groups. Plus, we take a look at other stories making the headlines from around the region. This is Connecticut East This Week. Hello, I'm Brian Scott Smith. It's a constant battle in the state and across the nation, that of homelessness. And since 2021 and the pandemic, the number of people who are homeless here in Connecticut has risen 14%. On any given night, around 4,000 people are using homeless shelters, and another 800 people are sleeping elsewhere, like their cars, camps, and even outside. And it's affecting everyone, whatever your gender or age, from young to old, college students, and even people who are employed, as rent prices skyrocket and evictions that were stopped during the pandemic have resumed. And the situation is exacerbated further by the lack of shelter space and affordable housing in the state. No region or county is unaffected by the homelessness situation. I sat down with Kathy Zoll, Executive Director of the New London Homeless Hospitality Centre, that provides shelter and services for those who are unhoused.
We normally do updates, Kathy, and it's actually been a while. We've sort of missed one, so I apologise for that, because we like to get these regular updates from you and your organisation, especially because homelessness, unhoused people, it's such a big issue. Tell us where we're at, you know, here in 2024.
Well, that's a big question. Thank you for the chance to share a few thoughts about that. I guess I would sort of two things come to my mind. First one, of course, which is the most visible to most people, is unsheltered homelessness. And I think we see across the country and in Connecticut that unsheltered homeless is an increasing challenge. And I think we are really thinking very hard. We're very grateful to be part of a HUD demonstration program. So we do have outreach workers who are actively out in encampments and looking for people in their cars, etc. So I think we are actually really quite in touch with who's outside and working one-on-one with people to assist them to come into some kind of shelter. So that's one part. But actually, probably more on my mind is the increase in homelessness that most people don't see. And that is people who have been housed stably for years, many of them senior citizens, who are now being displaced from where they are, either because their property was sold to an investor who quite understandably wants to upgrade and increase rents, or even just the rents where they've been have gone up very substantially. We have seen $500-$600 a month increases in rents. And I'm seeing an increasing number of people, as I said, mainly on fixed income and a lot of seniors who cannot find anywhere else to live. And so it's, if you were to look at the shelter, you will see many people. We have people 80 years old. We have people with disabilities who can't work. And so I'm very concerned, actually, about a section of our neighbors who are absolutely priced out of the housing market as it currently is, and what's going to happen for them. So that's probably actually my biggest on my mind at the moment.
Let's talk about the figures a little bit. We won't get into them too much because obviously the figures are constantly changing, but there is always these point in time counts that happen here in Connecticut and obviously elsewhere around the US as well. It isn't good. The figures are going up, and for some of the reasons that you have just stated. What's the sort of impact here in New London County, which is generally sort of your area? You've sort of like mention that you're seeing more people there. I mean, is there any glimmer at all of hope of anything like positive happening?
Well, there's always hope. I live in hope. But I would say if I think 5 years ago, if we had 3, 4, 5 people on our waiting list for shelter, that would be a lot. Today, it's often almost 20 and over. So the number of people in need of shelter has gone up. Our capacity has stayed the same. And the speed at which people can exit shelter to housing has gone down. And so for me, the shelter wait list is, what's that, canary in the coal mine. In other words, as that number goes up, that means more and more people who have demonstrated that they are in need of shelter and we cannot provide it because we don't have the space. So yes, I think clearly the numbers are going up here and across the country.
And one of the things that your organization and the other organizations started, I believe, like last year, it was a coordinated effort. It was called Welcome Home Neighbor, and it was Fairfield, Litchfield counties and New London County. Talk to us about that, because it's sort of 2023, it started. Where's it at now?
So Welcome Home Neighbor was an effort to work more effectively with private landlords. Obviously, there's the need for public investment in housing, and I'm very much in favor of that. But most housing that people are going to access is in the private market. And so I think we've made a lot of progress with working more effectively with landlords, helping them understand the needs of populations that we're working with. Sometimes we are working with people who won't have a perfect credit score, but there's all kinds of good reasons for that, and being able to talk with landlords about this person's now working, and also protecting landlords from some of the downsides, like if they have damages, we can help, you know, pay for some of those. So I think we're working more effectively with landlords. The challenge is that Welcome Home Neighbor doesn't in and of itself increase more housing or reduce housing costs. So it's not the panacea, because if the market goes way above what people can afford, or if there simply just aren't enough physical units, as well as we work with private landlords, that's not going to solve the problem of people being unable to find housing.
Yeah, I mean, the market seems to still be very high when it comes to house prices. Also, housing affordable for all is something which we're still not seeing enough of, not just here in New London County, but obviously across Connecticut as well. But that said, there has been a lot of construction and apartments being built here in, certainly in New London. So talk to us a little bit about that. Is any of that helping the situation at all? Because some of that has actually been affordable housing.
Yes. So I think from my point of view, all housing is good. So there's been a mix of housing development in New London, which I'm very excited about. Some of it is very high income. And again, one of the things, and I think this is absolutely true, is that as even more expensive units are available, it does release pressure on the less expensive units, which people who can't find housing have been occupying. So I think all kinds of housing is a plus, and it's a huge plus for New London that we have so much new housing. And it is helping. There is some affordable housing for, let's say, the person who's maybe earning $22, $23 an hour, and that's a very important market. But where we still are struggling is for the what's called deeply affordable. The person who has a Social Security check of $1,000 a month, the person who works part-time at the minimum wage, the person who is disabled and is waiting for a Social Security benefit. In other words, I would say that we still need greater investment in the housing affordable to our lowest income neighbors.
You're a very eminent voice, obviously, in this particular sector here in New London. How much do they listen to organizations like yourself and others here when it comes to, we're going to be building this? Do you get any input at all? Do they ask any input of you to say, you know, what is it that's actually needed? Because it's all very well building this stuff. Nobody knows everything sort of thing. So, I mean, do they come to organizations like yours to say, can you give us some input?
Not really. I mean, again, I think we need to recognize that housing development in New London and probably most of the United States is driven by the private market. There are some public projects, but it's driven by the private market. So there's a whole variety of private developers who are out making decisions and are influenced by public policy. They're influenced by tax credits that's available to make their project more affordable if they have some units that are less expensive. But I don't get the sense of some kind of a strategy overall that's guiding this and is saying, here's a need, let's reach out and find a developer who wants to do this. I think, though, that from a public policy point of view, the biggest challenge for me, and this is very active in the legislature now, is zoning. So even where there are people that would like to do some creative, affordable housing, making housing affordable often goes with higher density, right? The one family house on a half an acre is never going to be, I think, as affordable as a townhouse or a small apartment complex. And across the state, the opposition to any kind of higher density housing from local zoning has been very intense. And honestly, knowing that you're going to have to navigate the hurdles of a long, complicated, expensive zoning process, I think does discourage people who might otherwise be considering developing this kind of housing.
Is that also in part, though, because the state sort of, a little while ago, was sort of getting on their high horse a bit and was like saying, we may start dictating to the municipalities when it comes to the zoning. And of course, nobody likes to be told what they can do in their own backyard. So did the state handle that a little bit badly?
I am no expert on this. The only thing that I think I could say as just a person at the ground level is that for me, the housing crisis is very much a supply crisis. It's an income side too. I mean, not saying that, but it's a supply crisis. We need much more housing. And how that should be accomplished with mandates, with investment, with whatever, but I have not yet seen the strategy and the will to say we need to make a huge investment in a bigger supply of housing at all levels. Affordable for all is a very good goal.
The other issue, of course, we have here in southeastern and eastern Connecticut is our transportation systems aren't as good as many others elsewhere. Certainly central Connecticut has much more by way of rail, by way of accessibility, buses, etc. That also must play into this because housing, of course, is a very important thing. We don't want to see anybody unhoused or without a home. And also, if they want to get to a job, you know, they may not be able to afford a car. So obviously, public transport. How are those things? I mean, are you seeing anything in that as well? I mean, I know that you're primarily focused, obviously, on housing people. But like we said, transportation surely has to go hand in hand with that as well. If they want a job and they want to be able to get to a job.
Yes, transportation is huge. We see it all the time. I would say a couple things. I think that the New London experiment with point-to-point transportation is huge. And I did read recently that that was being extended to a larger area around New London. And I think that just seems to me like such an important innovation. And then, of course, people talk all the time about transit-oriented development. So how do we locate affordable housing in places that are contiguous to existing transportation networks? So I think there are strategies out there that could not solve this problem, and especially in the, you know, the northern part of eastern Connecticut, it is just unbelievably difficult for people to find housing that they can still access work, grocery stores, and things like that.
When you look at certain parts of Connecticut, and like you said, the northeast, there's plenty of places that you can build, there's brownfield sites, but that isn't, as you say, that's not transit-orientated development because it's nowhere near any form of transit, easy transit again, and if they do actually build there again, you would need a vehicle, a personal vehicle to get back and forth. So it becomes an issue. Talk to us about things happening in, you know, the legislature. We've just seen the end, obviously, of the current short 2024 legislative session. Did anything come out of that at all that has been positive?
My key concern, and obviously this is narrow and fairly parochial, is something that we call winter funding. So last year, there was a special appropriation in the legislature to help us pay for winter no freeze. And basically what that means is that during the year, we have a shelter that has 40 beds and a wait list. But obviously, if you start to think about a wait list when it's 0 degrees outside, you instantly see that having a wait list in good weather is not a good thing, but to have a wait list in dangerous weather conditions is a prescription for somebody to die. And so I don't mean to be overly dramatic, but we really need the support, which we got last year and we're very grateful for ongoing ability to have a warming center. It's nothing fancy. It's just to say during the winter, when being outside is a threat to health, an emergency, we want to be able to have a safe place. We can open the door to people in our area who need a place that they can stay warm. And I understand that this is still advancing in the legislature. I'm hoping it will get funded at least for another year. But I think this should be an ongoing support. I mean, this just doesn't seem to me to be like outrageous idea that we do not want people to die outside in the state of Connecticut in the winter. And so I'm just hopeful, obviously for this year, but also for an ongoing basis that we invest in having that option available for people in the cold weather.
Some of the things that obviously came out of the short session this year was this constant use of the word financial guardrails. And it's something that the Lamont administration put in place and they say has helped the state. We're not going to get deep into that. I mean, that's another discussion entirely. But nonprofits have said we're not getting the money that we need to do our work. And that's not just nonprofits like yourself, but many nonprofits across the state. The state, of course, has said, hey, you know, guardrails, no more money sort of thing. But then, of course, there's this ARPA money, this unspent ARPA money as well. Are you hopeful that they will discharge some of that funding? Because we understand it's in the many millions of dollars, certainly. The nonprofits do need it.
Yeah, as I understand it, the ARPA funds are a source that's being looked at for the winter funding. I think the challenge with ARPA, as much as it has been transformative for us and for what we've done, and we're so grateful for it, there's a cliff, right? And you cannot build a sustainable organization with funding that you know is going to disappear on June 30th of 2025. So I think the state faces a difficult challenge, which is to use that ARPA money effectively, but it's not going to be able to address the long-term issues of sustainability of the ongoing work that I think the not-for-profit sector is doing. Way beyond my pay grade to understand how to do that, but it's not going to be that one-time funding. We need a sustainable funding source for the kind of work that needs to be done.
Also seems as well that everywhere you look, costs are just going up all the time, or they're not coming back down. I mean, you know, we all went through that pandemic. We saw things go up in price, like supply chains. We're hopefully now seeing the back of that, but we don't seem to be seeing prices come back down. So again, this must be impacting nonprofits as well as, you know, other sectors. How is that affecting you? I mean, it's like, is your money stretching any further or not?
Well, I would say the primary impact, of course, we've talked about is rent costs. And that's not just affecting people experiencing homelessness. That's impacting staff. So this is probably one of the first years that I remember staff members facing the prospect of homelessness. So in other words, I think that's the biggest impact, is that we need to be able to pay a living wage to the people that are doing this very difficult work so that they can get to work and concentrate on work and not be worrying about battling homelessness. But the other thing I do think is that we in the not-for-profit sector need to keep thinking, how can we do better? How can we rethink what we do? How can we be more effective? Because there's always ways, right? There's always ways to do things better, to rethink, to use technology more effectively, and many other, you know, strategies, which again, I feel meant much of the state is encouraging us to do, but sometimes it's hard because the rules, there's so many rules. So I think we need both. We need investment, we need to pay people a living wage, and then we need to encourage innovation as much as we possibly can.
What about more partnerships? I mean, I know that nonprofits do partner. You don't just all work in silos, and partnerships have been increasing. We spoke about one obviously earlier in this interview. Is that another way that, or another thing that you're looking at, is maybe partnering to try and, as I say, stretch those dollars to stretch the services?
Partnership is key. partnership is key. And the homeless response system is organized around what are called coordinated access networks, or CANs. And that's the whole idea, is that no one agency has everything that an individual is going to need, or a family, in order to escape homelessness. And we work every day to think about how do we coordinate our work. But also, when I really try to think about this from the perspective of a person experiencing homelessness, it must be so overwhelming to be in crisis and then have all these agencies who have different schedules and different names and different access points. I mean, I almost can't imagine how people navigate that. So one of the things that the Department of Housing has implemented, which I think is interesting, is something called a hub. So we now have here, and we happen to be the hub for New London County, a location where somebody experiencing homelessness can come or call and really get help navigating all of these different opportunities. Plus, the department has provided some flexible funding. Let's say I'm released from incarceration. You're released from incarceration wherever you were sentenced, but maybe you're not from here, and maybe a bus ticket would help you get home to Arkansas or to Boston, but you don't have any money. So the idea, that's just one simple example of a hub, is a place where somebody can go. We can help them. Can you reconnect with your family? We can help them figure out how to get a bus ticket. We can help them with the cost and many, many other things like that. So I'm very excited about that because it's collaboration between agencies, but it's also kind of helping an individual navigate that partnership, those partnerships. So I think that's a really positive step.
It's been great talking to you. As I said, it's been a while since obviously we did a catch up with you. Any final message before we go?
I guess I would just try to encourage people to think that we are one community. And as much as we think we can separate ourselves from the challenges of our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness, we are one people, one community. And so I just like to keep saying that it's in all of our interest to take care of each other, and I hope we can see even more of that.
Kathy Zoll, Executive Director of the New London Homeless Hospitality Centre, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
And if you're experiencing a housing crisis or know someone who is, then shelter and other details can be found at the New London Homeless Hospitality Centre's website at nlhhc.org, or you can phone the hub at the centre for immediate assistance for services on 860 580 6800. That's 860 580 6800. Connecticut East this week is made possible by Arisu Anime, a Japanese pop culture haven nestled in Mystic and Fairfield, Connecticut, specializing in anime and manga merchandise, featuring an integrated Japanese convenience section designed to mirror Tokyo's vibrant streets. Arisu offers an immersive shopping experience, complete with towering statues and authentic capsule machines. Whether you're a seasoned collector or a curious newcomer, Arisu invites you to explore a world where fantasy and reality merge at Arisu Anime, that's ArisuAnime.com. Newport Mansions, as seen on HBO's The Gilded Age. Newport Mansions preserves and protects 11 historic properties and landscapes in Newport, Rhode Island, exemplifying three centuries of achievements in American architecture, decorative arts, and landscape design. Plan your visit this year and attend some of the mansion's signature events, including the Newport Flower Show, June 21st to 23rd, Newport Mansions Wine and Food Festival, September 20 to 22nd, and holidays at the Newport Mansions, November 23rd to January 1st. Tickets and information at newportmansions.org. And
SCAD, the Southeastern Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, is looking for licensed clinicians and is offering the top benefits packages in the state. Go to licensedclinicians.org to learn more. That's licensedclinicians.org.
Time now for a look at other stories making the headlines this week. The Connecticut 2024 legislative session has come to an end. One of the big agenda items was the state's unspent American Rescue Plan Act funds, known as ARPA, that were provided by the federal government to aid public health and economic recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. The unspent funds must be assigned by December 31st of this year, or the money must be returned to the federal government. Connecticut has around $370 million in unspent ARPA money, and because of fiscal guardrails set out by Governor Lamont in the last budget. The legislator are using these funds to plug gaps and provide additional funding in what has been called a budget stabilization bill that avoids them formally adjusting the state's $26 billion budget that was adopted last June for the 2024-2025 fiscal year. The bill will go to the governor to sign, and included in the bill, higher education in the state is earmarked to get around half of the stabilization funds or ARPA money, which would go to the state's community colleges, regional state universities, and to UConn. The bill will also provide around $15 million for nonprofits in the state that deliver the bulk of state-sponsored social services for people with disabilities or patients struggling with mental health or addiction issues. There is also $18.8 million included for the Connecticut Care for Kids program, a partnership between the state and various childcare service providers. It also includes just over $8 million for other childcare and early childhood development programs. And $26 million will be used to expand behavioral health services for children and other related programs. Connecticut's towns and cities will also benefit from the unspent ARPA funds, as will the Shoreline East Rail Service, which Josh Morgan, a spokesperson for the Connecticut Department of Transportation, who runs the state's rail services, said if approved will receive $5 million, which will allow CTDOT to provide two additional AM trains and two additional PM trains on the service, bringing the total number of daily trains from 16 to 20. Morgan said the state has to coordinate this with Amtrak, who owns the rail line, but if approved, the additional services could start by the end of the year. Shoreline East Rail Service has been a hot topic with rail users ever since its service was reduced before the COVID-19 pandemic and then further reduced to just 40% of its previous service levels. Several Connecticut counties rank poorly in the latest State of the Air report by the American Lung Association. Edwin J. Vieira from the Connecticut News Service has this report.
Four counties measured for ozone pollution received failing grades, while three others got C's. These stem from transportation emissions, the state's largest contributor to greenhouse gases. Ruth Canovi with the American Lung Association in Connecticut says ozone pollution comes with serious health impacts.
I've had doctors explain it as almost like a sunburn on the lung. It really causes irritation. High ozone levels can be linked to chest tightness, shortness of breath, coughing, cardiovascular issues, so heart issues, worsening of already existing asthma.
There are ways for the General Assembly to tackle air quality issues. Bills related to climate change and renewable energy can help reduce ozone pollution and poor air quality. Canovi notes the Environmental Protection Agency's new clean truck standards can reduce nationwide emissions by up to 60% by 2032 and prevent 1 billion metric tons of carbon pollution. I'm Edwin J. Vieira.
As many electric customers in the state see their bills and rates increase, customers of Groton Utilities will see their monthly electricity bill decrease by around 9.4%. The town's utility company said that energy costs are decreasing, and the utility is using $1 million from its rate stabilization fund to further reduce rates for its customers. A spokesman for the utility said that although transmission and distribution costs have increased, the cost of energy is decreasing, and they are using their rainy day fund to help offset the increases for their customers. And the new president of Eastern Connecticut State University has been announced. Chancellor Terence Cheng of Connecticut State Colleges and Universities said he will appoint Dr. Kareem Ismaili as the university's seventh president. Ismaili is currently executive vice president and provost at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. He will begin his new role as president of Eastern on July 31st. Eastern's current president, Elsa Nunes, announced her retirement in 2023 after 18 years as head of the university. Nunes was the first Latina to serve as a university president in New England and is also credited with making the opportunity to attend college more accessible to students of color and those from marginalized backgrounds who may be the first in their family to attend higher education organizations. That's all from us for this edition. Do send us your questions and story ideas to the show via our website at connecticut-east.com or Facebook or Twitter at Connecticut East and on Instagram at Connecticut East This Week. And you can listen to the show again on our social platforms, on demand, and by asking your smart speaker to play Connecticut East This Week podcast. And please like, follow, and share on your social media too. I'm Brian Scott-Smith. Thank you for listening.